Today is November 21st, 2021. This is part 23 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, last name spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing excellent, Tom.
Great.
Excellent.
Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You certainly can.
Thank you so much. We left off last time in the fall of 2007, and I think you were going to pick up a hike in the spring of 2008. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was actually in the spring of 2007 when we did our hikes into Tattahatchee Canyon and also Tyndall Dome, and so there wasn't a fall trip that year. But certainly in March of 2008 we were ready to go again. And this one was a great hike, and we put some thought into planning it. Well, we always do that, but more than normal, I think. And so the three of us, Bruce Grubbs and Art and myself, decided that we'd do a loop, kind of around Walhalla Plateau from Saddle Canyon to Grand Canyon Village, essentially Bright Angel. And the idea was we wanted to get as many summits as possible. So this was a backpacking loop, of course. And so we figured to do about 12 days worth of camping and hiking, and we figured we'd get about 12 summits or 13 summits along the way. So it was going to be a pretty comprehensive walk through the Eastern Canyon.
Yeah.
And in places, you know, duplicating where we had hiked before, but none of us had done this entire, loop itself. So that was a neat benefit to it, right? That it was going to be a lot of new ground for all three of us. So I flew down from Vancouver. I think it was March 16th, and unfortunately there was a big storm in the area in the Colorado Plateau. And so there was a big dump in Flagstaff on that day, I guess. And we decided to hang out. This is Art and I, because Bruce lives in Flagstaff. So Art and I decided to hang out in Phoenix for a day. And I stayed with my mother and visited with her. And then he came up and got me the next day, and we headed up to Flagstaff. And since it was a leisurely afternoon or day trip during the day that we went up there, we had some time to kill in Flagstaff, and we visited with Bruce and his partner Dewart, and then the plan was to bring one vehicle to Grand Canyon Village, park it there, so that we would have a quick departure from the canyon at the end of the trip.
Okay.
Because this is a one-way trip from House Rock Valley to Grand Canyon Village, we needed to set up this shuttle. So, the three of us piled into the two cars. So I went in Bruce's car, and Art drove his car up, and we drove to the village, left Art's car there, and then went back to Flagstaff for that night.
Okay.
And then on the morning of the 18th, then the three of us, as well as our friend Gene Rakula, this is a friend of Art's, more than mine, but really nice.
Gene is a Forest Service lookout tower person, and she's a writer.
Yes, that's right.
Got it.
Yeah, she's got a pretty eclectic career.
Yeah,
and so she worked also with. I think she worked in the mountaineering shop, the old Alpineer mountaineering shop that Bruce had run in Flagstaff in the 70s. So. Yeah, Jean, she's had a long history, I guess, working in the Colorado Plateau and hiking and living there. And so she offered to drive Bruce's car back from the Saddle Canyon trailhead to Flagstaff so that we would just have one car out there, which would be Art's.
Nice.
At the village. You know, So that worked out well, and we drove up there, and we stopped at Marble Canyon Lodge. Pre-fire, of course, and had our traditional, we call it the Navajo breakfast, which is, it's just whatever we eat, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's
mm-hmm.
it's on Navajo land, and I remember that each time we would go through Marble Canyon Lodge, we were always hoping to get Vera, the waitress there that we really enjoyed interacting with her, a Navajo waitress. And she wasn't around on this particular trip. And anyways, the four of us then continued on into House Rock Valley, and because of the big snow that had come through the day before, day and a half before, there was a lot of snow on Saddle Mountain, and we were kind of concerned that it would be problematic getting up to the saddle of Saddle Mountain, right, from the House Rock Valley trailhead.
Right.
And we did this in the 70s when we climbed Quoggin. We actually brought snowshoes in, and were able to manage the deep snow going up to the Saddle Mountain saddle there with the snowshoes, but we didn't have any snowshoes this time. So we figured that what we'd do is we'd take the trail that goes along the north side of Saddle Mountain and then drop down at the break, drop down into the canyon at the break that's right on the old park boundary at what's called Boundary Ridge. And so, we left the vehicle around 11 in the morning, and then hiked down to Crossed Saddle Canyon on the trail, found the trail to the east, which, of course, diverges there from the main trail, which heads south and up to the saddle where you join the Nanquip Trail, right?
Right.
And so we headed east along the north side of Saddle Mountain. And, you know, it's kind of tough going in there when there was snow, too, on the north-facing slopes. Because
right.
And the trail is not laid out that well from a strategic point of view, because you're going along horizontal, and then there's a drainage that you have to cross, north trending drainage. And there's a number of them. There's five or six of them that are fairly significant. And the trail, rather than going to the south and contouring and not losing any elevation to cross this drainage, and then contouring back out on the other side and maintaining the same elevation, the trail is essentially just, it plunges down to the north and goes down the dip slope. And then you, the dip slope of the strata. So you then cross the drainage way downstream, and then you have to come back upstream, climbing all the way back up to regain that elevation.
Yeah.
Now keep in mind, we had, 10 days worth of food.
Oh.
And stuff on our back, so it was pretty strenuous and fatiguing. So we took it easy, and it took us pretty much most of the day to get out to the drop off point there at the boundary, the old boundary. And there's a big pile, a big cairn there, which I assume was from mapping, early mapping efforts. There is a benchmark shown there, so it could be that that's related to that. But the drop off starts right there, and it's incredible, because right from the rim, you're passing packs, and you go down a couple tens of feet scrambling, and then you have to start going down through vertical drops, and nothing really difficult, but we had to take our packs off and pass them back and forth, and just lots of steep topography to negotiate through there, and interesting little cliffs you figure out the way to get through, and moving back and forth on ledges as one always does, right?
Yeah.
So eventually we got down through the Kaibab and then the Torweep, and then we headed a little bit to the south to get more or less onto the main ridge, which heads down to the southeast. And then the Coconino break there is pretty impressive, because it's not from above, you don't see anything opening up, right? It's just very steep, and you can see everything way below down in the Supai, but you can't see your break through the Coconino. And we'd never come up this way before, so we weren't familiar with where it might go, but we just kept poking our noses out to the east over these ledges, and there would be some place to step down to, and eventually we got down through the Coconino. I mean, nothing formidable by any means, but just a lot of fun, piecing it together and, you know, wondering if you're going the right way, and then success when you realize you have, you know. So just a lot of fun to do that descent. And then from there, it was a fairly straight shot to follow this ridge down. So this ridge is essentially trending southeast to Little Nanqueep Creek.
Right.
And because it was late in the day, we got down to the Supai there, the probably the Esplanade Sandstone, the uppermost Supai ledges, and figured that we'd camp there, and we actually found some water, so that was pretty useful too. Not much, but a little bit. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a great night there, and perfect sleeping. I remember that. Very cool and perfectly crisp clear. And in the morning, we got up. We made sure we got up so that we could see the space station go overhead.
Oh, wow.
And Bruce had followed up on this, and he had determined from reading, you know, the sources back then. I guess it was a bit. This would have been an internet era, so he probably got this information online.
Yeah.
And you know, that the space shuttle goes over at certain times, and I'm sorry, the space station goes over at certain times. And in this particular case, this particular instance, the shuttle was actually docked to it.
Oh, wow.
So, it was extremely bright, and we saw this about 6:15 in the morning, just before the sun started to come up. Right, it was pretty neat seeing it go over. And in addition, that was the morning of my birthday.
Oh well,
March 19th, and so right after we watching the space station go by, Bruce pulls out these little wrapped packages from his backpack. With a little bow on, each of them had a little bow on it, and the first one was given to me, and it was I unwrapped it, and it was a bandana of Grand Canyon, a Grand Canyon bandana with animal tracks on it, right? So,
nice.
So it was pretty fun to get a birthday present in the bottom of Grand Canyon, or down in the canyon
like that,
in a very remote setting, and then Duard, Bruce's partner, had actually, you know, she come up with the idea to get these presents. So she had given one to Art as well, and then was also one for Bruce himself. So Bruce unloaded two of the presents onto Art and I to carry for the rest of the trip, and he had his own. So it was a fun little morning, and we eventually got packed up and pretty early and headed for Little Nanqueep. And so, you know, we'd been up Little Nanqueep before, and it was not any big deal. But this time, when we were coming in from above, we actually overshot it, shot the descent. And there was there's a really good trail at that area, and I assume that this is in part produced by the river runners.
Right.
But the trail we were following, you know, it continued to the west along the Red Wall Rim, and went farther than we really needed to go. And so it was eventually, you know, after a few minutes, it wasn't like we were spending much time on this at all, but we did realize the error of our ways. I guess probably we looked over our shoulders and we could see the buttress that, you know, the descent actually goes down, and we realized we'd come too far. So we backtracked, but I still wonder what that trail was all about, you know, and probably just a deer trail and sheep trail, maybe wanting to get into the upper part of Little Nanqueep Creek. I don't know, but anyways, we reversed our steps and got back to the proper descent route, and then had a fun little drop down that. It's just such a gorgeous hike. I know you've done it. Probably many times on your river trips, and it's one of those climbs where it's just super steep, and but just huge holes everywhere you step. And
yeah.
And at one point we did have to pass our packs down, but nothing really technical climbing or anything like that. It was just to you know, facilitate the process of getting down through these cliffs. So
yeah, so.
We got down to the bottom there, and then relaxed before we headed over to to Nankweep. And the flow in Nankweep was very impressive on this particular trip. I remember that we actually had to, you know, we just wear, you know, tennis shoes or Merrell-type hiking shoes, right? Nothing really heavy-duty on our feet. And we had to, you know, hop and wade a little bit in the creek to cross Nankweep because there was so much flow there.
Wow.
And so then we followed the trail network that exists along the delta there, which fortunately, you know, facilitates your walking quite dramatically. And of course you get to look up at the cliff dwellings up there, and it was pretty cool to see all those, because I still haven't been up to those dwellings since I was there with my uncle in 1978 or something like that. We talked about that.
Yeah.
And that was almost, God, Tom, that would have been like 30 years before this trip. So
yeah,
pretty amazing that time goes by like this.
Yep.
You know, we followed the trails south along the west bank of the Colorado River, and they start to fade out, and you don't, after a mile or two, it's kind of tough going when you're pushing through the tamarisk and the acacia and the willows, and you know, you've got steep talus that you having to walk along as well, and so it's kind of slow going, and there's no really consistent trail, at least there wasn't then. And I remember we hiked down there a couple of miles south of Nankweep, and we got a good view across to Gray Castle, and which is a pile of Bright Angel shale that was just actually recently climbed.
Right.
Yep, by Jake Daly.
Did you talk to Jake about that climb?
Yes, I did. Yes, and actually, I forgot, because he gave me permission to send you the photos.
Well, I'd love to see them.
Yeah, I've got to do that. Maybe you can fire me an email to remind me to do that. But yeah, he said it was. I haven't spoken with him directly, but just email, and he said it was very unnerving.
I bet.
Yeah, to say the least. But they did a multi-pitch climb. And on very rotten shale.
I mean, multi-pitch is really something, because the thing is only like 100 feet high.
Yeah, well, I think it's because it kind of wanders back and forth.
Clearly must have. Wow.
Yeah, and
pitch
I also
really
think
hard.
They wanted to put in reasonably secure belays where they could get them. You know what
got
I mean?
Got it, sure.
Yeah.
Very, very difficult climb.
Yeah. Yeah, the last unclimbed named summit.
Right.
In the Grand Canyon.
Right.
So, anyways, we looked across at it from the river and figured we'd never climb it, and I still feel like I probably won't. So. And then we started south and continued south and, you know, walked down past Quaggint, the mouth of Quaggint, and then continued down. And this was basically, you know, to get us into walking this the riverbank, was to get us into the canyon, into an area that we could start then bagging summits. So so we knew we had a couple of days of approach, right, to get into the area where we'd be climbing summits. And our walk down Marble Canyon was that multi-day approach to the climbing area. So, we followed the west bank of the river south, and eventually it starts to pick up a little bit, because around the hiking starts to pick up a bit around between Ahwatobee and 60 Mile Creeks. You start to the Tapete sandstone starts to crop out along the riverbank, and so you get, you know, increasing amounts of sandstone ledges that you can walk along at river level, as opposed to having to constantly sidewalk on the talus slopes. And so again, the hiking picks up a bit, and eventually when the Tapetes started to pick up or crop out, we decided we'd camp there for the night. And so we settled in and on some some reasonable ledges, and had another very comfortable night's sleep.
Nice.
Just great, right next to the river, wandering by there. So, and again, we had perfect weather this entire 10 days. So we had timed this just wonderfully, because the big snow had come through, which had dumped moisture in the areas where we needed it.
Very nice.
And yet we just had clear skies most of the way after, for the whole 10 days we were out. So so the next morning we got up and we started hiking downriver, and the objective today was to get into Carbon Creek. And so we basically just followed the riverbank, and it gets increasingly easy walking down to the confluence.
Right.
There's some really interesting phenomena or things that we ran across in there. Like, there was one very extensive sandbar on river. There was a mini weather station set up there, like a wind cup anemometer.
Wait, sorry, that's on river right?
That's on river right, yeah.
Okay.
Are you familiar with it?
Yeah. There's this really nice sandbar there. The phone just cut out for a minute, and I was just like, okay, I better get you to say river right again.
Yeah. That's. I think it's probably somebody trying to call in now. But no problem. So, it's on river right, and we don't know exactly what that was for, whether it was for monitoring river water levels or sand or wind.
There are some sand studies that are going on, and they set these things up. And they look like, they just kind of remind me about the little, the Star Wars thing about the remote sensor on the ice planet Hoth or something like that. They're these crazy looking little gizmos, and they collect sand, wind-blown sand.
Oh, okay. Oh, that makes sense. So they can, they can monitor the, I guess they can figure out what kind of sand, what size of sand is being carried by what force of wind.
That's right.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well,
but crazy
anyways,
machines. Yeah.
Yeah. So we walked right past one of these, and we knew it was something scientific, obviously, but not quite, couldn't quite piece it together. So I'm glad you clarified that for me. And then a little bit past that, there was this really interesting thing that we ran across, and you may be familiar with this, I don't know, but behind some boulders on river right, up on the sandstone ledges in the tapetes there was this accumulation of like two dozen or 15 or 20 balls of varying types, soccer balls, footballs, beach balls, and the only thing I could figure was that these are from, river running trips where people have brought these along for entertainment. And then maybe they get loose off the boats and they float in the water. And then somebody was picking them up and kind of stashing them all, I guess.
Pretty
I don't know.
Close.
But...
Pretty close. There were a bunch of fish studies that happened, and those guys had sport boats. And when the LCR would flood, there were a ton of balls down there. They would scoop these things up, and then they would pitch them from the boat up behind that little shelf there. and they're still there today.
Okay, it's funny how the stories of the river runners and the hikers kind of come together and interweave,
Yeah.
Yeah, we had no idea what this was all about, but we kind of figured it had to be something like that, So,
yeah.
That was pretty fun. So,
cool.
Yeah, so we continued south then down to the junction, and you could see. The Little Colorado was heavily flooding, right? Mm. And so it's just this murky, reddish brown flow coming out of that, mixing with the clear, greenish flow of the Big Colorado. And it took it was several miles downriver before the two water bodies actually mixed together, so you couldn't see the residual of one or the other current,
nice.
Right? But the walking down from the confluence becomes progressively more difficult,
yes.
And eventually you have to climb up to get around some cliffs at water level. You climb up to the level of the Tonto platform, the top of the Tapetes sandstone, and where you basically stay until you get to carbon.
Right.
And of course, there's the area in there where there's all the debris from the 1956, I believe it was, airline crash.
That's
over
right.
Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
And we were actually surprised at the amount of debris that was still there.
Mm.
Because I was under the impression that, you know, the Park Service had cleaned it out. And, you know, obviously, you know, an effort like that would never get everything. But there were some, you know, seat backs and things like that that we found.
Yep.
And it could be that hikers going through there have kind of pulled these things out and made them more accessible.
You know, to the park's credit, they did a ton of cleanup there, but there was a ton of debris.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just, they didn't get everything. And, you know, it's today, you know, we get down to the little fingernail size, you know, stuff gets all scooped up. Not then.
Yeah.
They had to come back in the 70s and do another cleanup. Because just everything was left there. So,
Well, we spent a little bit of time there because, you know, it was unexpected to us. I mean, we knew we were going to be walking through the area, and I knew that there were, you know, large pieces of debris which were up on the cliffs, which could not be retrieved, which are visible from certain orientations. But we were surprised when we found this stuff down on the hikeable slope. So we kind of paused there for a while and looked around through stuff. And, you know, it's a very sobering experience, right, to be in a place like that or that place. And so it was, you know, just a time to pause and reflect, I think, and give thanks that we, you know, had not suffered similarly in our lives. So, anyways, we continued on, and, you know, the hiking, have you done that stretch of the river there?
I have, and I remember it being really rather difficult, surprisingly difficult. We called it the Beamer West. For the Beamer Trail, which we could see across the way around lucky people over there.
Right.
And then there's a fascinating pinch point to get off of Tepetz and into Carbon. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, yeah. Actually, for sure. And we had started this trip and we thought we knew everything about the canyon, of course, right?
Like everybody,
you forget things after 40 years. The three of us were kind of convinced that there was a drop down to the river at the mouth of Carbon from the Tepetz.
So
as you say, you know, it's difficult hiking. And I remember that it was mid-March, and it was kind of sunny and hot, for me anyways. And, you know, I was feeling that heat. And so I was pretty tired, and it was late in the day by the time we got to the mouth of Carbon. But we're, 600 feet above the river, right?
Right.
And we're saying, well, you know, there's this break somewhere, right?
And
we're
looking down. There's got to be water down there, and it'll be easy, and we'll go right there.
But, you know, there's no break there, and the cliffs
right.
are... The cliffs are pretty sheer and continuous,
and so
we realized, okay, we're going to have to, you know, stay at this elevation and walk around into Carbon and over to the Butte Fault, and just before we got to the fault, there was a way to slip down into the bed of Carbon Creek. I don't remember it being that challenging.
No, but it forces you, the landscape forces you to that one little way down. And I was like, gee whiz, if we don't find a little way down here, we're going to be hurting for a while. And there it was, right there. So.
Yeah, for sure. And we, by the time we got there, it was getting pretty dark, you know. We didn't have to pull our headlamps out because I don't like to do that until it's pitch, right? And it's my own personal feeling, right? I'd rather let my eyes deal with the dim light.
Yeah.
But it was at the point, you know, where if, you know, 10 minutes later, we would have definitely been in headlamp mode because it was just that late in the day. So we were really fortunate because if it had been that dark, we might not have seen this break or been able to find it easily, right? So, we were quite fortunate then to be able to get down to the bed of Carbon. And then we hiked upstream just a little ways to where the fault actually crosses. And there was water there, although very salty.
Right.
And so we camped there for the night, and it was a nice little spot, a good ending to the day. So, so you know, by this time now, we're finally finished our approach, right? The approach to our climbing trip, which was to get into the valley of Char and basalt and Angkor and do some climbing. So we were getting pretty jazzed about this. And then, so the next morning we got up and we had easy hiking up Char Creek, and you just hike upstream and eventually far, reasonable. So this drainage goes up west of Carbon Butte.
Okay.
If you're familiar with
that,
and I'm sure you are. And then at one point there's a very small, very low saddle on the west side of west. It's actually the West Fork of Carbon Creek.
Right.
And and then there's a small saddle, and you drop, pop up over the top of that, maybe 60 feet high or something like that. Not much relief, and then you're into Char Creek itself.
Right.
And so our plan was that we were hoping to hit water there in Char Creek.
Okay.
And so we were going to camp there and then go up and do Cochise and Gunther Buttes that day, right? But there was no water there.
Really?
So no, not where we
interesting. Huh.
Yeah, not where we first met the creek. So we had to hike down Char until we got to Lava Creek,
And
there was good
water,
flow there.
That water can be, in the certain times of the year, that water is kind of not so good. But when there's a lot of water in the canyon, that water is pretty good.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and we found it perfect, right?
Great.
So we got down there and then decided, and we relaxed a little bit. And it's still fairly early in the morning, right? We hadn't hiked very far from our camp in Carbon, and so we started up towards Gunther and Cochise, and the three of us.
Okay.
And we got about halfway up to the Tapetes. And I tell you, I at that point, I was just getting pretty bagged. I don't know what it was, but I used to say that this was, attributed to the fact that I live at sea level nowadays.
Right.
And sometimes I'm not in the best of shape when I start these trips, and so the combination, and of course I live in Canada where it's a little bit cooler typically than Arizona. So,
right.
I spend the winters indoors, not accommodating or getting accustomed to the sun. So, all these climatic factors, I think, combined with fitness levels, basically was taking it out of me. So,
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I basically at a certain point I said, I'm gonna relax the rest of the day here. So Bruce and I went back down to Lava Creek and back to where we dropped our packs. And Art continued up into the valley, not necessarily to go for the summits, but just to see what it was like up there. So he actually went up to the Tapetes and got above the Tapetes and made sure that we could do that easily the next day. So then he came back down, and the three of us reconvened in Lava Creek at our camp there and had a relaxing day, kind of recovering, I guess. I mean, that had been a fairly demanding hike down through Marble Canyon, from Little Nanqueep down to Carbon Creek. It took a lot out of us, so I was happy to rest and recuperate. So the next morning, we get up, and this time Bruce decided he wasn't going to go with us up to Cochise and Gunther, that he wanted to spend time up in Upper Lava.
Okay.
And I think he went up almost to the Hartman Bridge. So he had a pretty good day up in there. But Art and I started up, and we made really good time this day. Of course, we just got our day packs.
Right.
And worked our way up into this little valley above the Tapetes. And it's just, I don't know if you've been in there, but this was, this was in mid-March, springtime. There's snow on the ground in places, and there's wildflowers popping up, and there's pinyon juniper, and there's a talus of limestone, gray limestone talus. It's just blue skies and white puffy clouds. You can't ask for a more picturesque setting,
Nice.
And with all the snow, there was plenty of water, right? So that was another boon that we had. So we worked our way up through the red wall there to the summit of Cochise. It's not very, it's not a challenging climb by any means. It's just a third-class scramble, and the summit is not particularly nice because it's all jagged, sharp limestone blocks. Yeah. And I think we just kind of stood there and looked at the view, right, and chatted with each other. At least we got another summit, right? That was a big plus. The start of what we hoped to be was quite a few. And when we're sitting up on top of standing or whatever, however we were reposed on Cochise Butte there, we're looking across at Gunther, and I was looking at the north side of Gunther, and I said to Art, I think there might be a route through the red wall on the north side of Gunther, because the standard route that we had heard about was to go back down the drainage that we'd come up, and then cut up and follow a smaller subsidiary drainage up the south side of Gunther, and there's a nice, easy break through the red wall.
Right.
And so that was what we were planning to do, was to go back down and then find that break, which is down by the Tapetes Fall, and then work our way back up the south side of Gunther. But I said, I think we might be able to work our way from Cochise here down into the notch over to Gunther, and then maybe work our way up the north side on that in that gully there. And it wasn't 100% certain, but we went for it. And it was just one of those little hikes where it was perfect. You know, it was enough of a challenge on the climbing that you had to think about it and maybe get a little nervous, you know. Mm-hmm. But then it just went very, very simply. And so fairly quickly, we were then on top of Gunther. And I remember the view from Gunther just being extraordinary, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't know, it's like you're just in a place where you have the whole Butte Fault laid out below you, and all these summits on the east side of the Butte Fault, you know, from Nanquip Mesa on the north down to Temple Butte on the south. You just see these massifs lined up, you know, one after the other from north to south. Yeah. Very impressive place. And then, of course, you've also got a fairly, you know, if you turn around 180 degrees, you're looking at the North Rim and Walhalla Plateau, and, you know, it's all snow-covered and just gorgeous. So a really tremendous place to take in the view, and really one of my favorite summits from that perspective, nice. I think. So we spent some time on the top there, and then went down the standard route, which is the south side, and we worked our way down to the Tapetes there, and we actually found a very direct route into or down through the Tapetes, right above the it's hard for me to describe, but the way we'd read about in Butchert's notes was to go up farther up the drainage that we had come up that morning heading for Cochise, and then cut out of that drainage, and then well above the Tapetes, and then contour around, and then up through the red wall. And alternatively, you could go over closer to Galeros Butte,
okay.
and come up through the Tapetes there. But we were able to find a route right in the tiny little drainage that comes down. Well, it's actually the drainage that comes down the south side of Gunther. So
okay.
that was pretty neat, because it was it took some poking around and both of us, both Art and I, trying different options, you know, and finding out which one worked the best. And enough ledge connecting and down climbing that it made it all pretty fun and exciting. So that was a good way to end that, the hike of those two climbs. So at that point, then we just kind of moseyed back down to our camp in Lava Creek, where we met Bruce. We're kind of running out of time here, aren't we?
We are.
Are you there, Tom?
I am. I'm looking at the clock here. It's
okay.
It's quarter to six, so I think we're good.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I just, you know, you let me know if I'm going
you're,
too slow
no,
or whatever.
I'm just eating it up, taking it in.
Okay. So yeah, we get back down to Lava Creek, another night there on the flats, and then so the next day we were hoping to the plan from here was to actually tackle Venus and Apollo and Ochoa Point as well as Juno and Jupiter.
Okay.
But we had lost a day because of the weather, right? And at the beginning we lost a day because we delayed our departure from Phoenix. And then we also lost time in when I was kind of feeling lightheaded there
Right.
the day before. And so we realized we probably weren't going to be able to piece all these summits together. So we figured that we would drop Juno and Jupiter. And
Okay.
they're pretty easily accessible
Right.
from the rim too. So
From the north rim.
it wasn't, critical that we nab those on this trip. So we left our camp in Lava Creek and headed south across the flats there, and then you climb long shale slopes to get up to the Peets, and there's a nice break there with Deer Trail.
Why didn't you take your packs with you? Because you need to get to BA, and it sounds like, you're going to do Venus and Apollo, you're going to head
Well, we did have our
southwest.
packs.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We broke camp.
You did. All right,
Yeah,
got
we
it. I
broke our
missed that.
camp in
Okay.
lava and packed everything up
Got
and
it.
went up
Okay.
with our backpacks. And
Super.
yeah, and it's a very easy walk up that slope
Yeah.
and a nice deer trail through the Tapetes. Several options through there, right? Between landslid blocks of sandstone.
Right.
So, a very pleasant way to start the morning. And then you get on top of the Tapetes again, and you're basically on the Tonto platform equivalent, and it's fairly, flat going. I won't say it was easy, but it's straightforward to follow along at the horizontal there. So we're on the east side of Juno and Jupiter now, walking below them.
Right.
And we followed that red wall, I'm sorry, the Tapetes rim around
Okay.
until we got to the saddle that headed up between Venus and Apollo.
Right.
And we stopped there for lunch. And I remember this lunch very distinctly. You don't remember most of the lunches you have, but I remember this so distinctively because Art pulled out of his pack what he called pork strips and olives,
Oh, my
and
gosh.
he had a little container with a lid where he had olives in oil,
Wow.
and then he had these pork strips, and then I think he had Manchego cheese, And we're sitting here, and it's probably 85 degrees or 80 degrees maybe, and we're sitting in the shade, and I've got cashews and dried fruit, the same stuff that I've eaten for 35 years, and really could care less about, and Art's
Get
offering
with the
me
program
olives.
here, Jim. Gee whiz.
Yeah,
Oh,
it was
my gosh.
a very fun little lunch, let's put it that way. It was Art's great. He's always pulling out surprises like that, and it really kind of introduces levity to the trip. I remember one trip, this is an aside, but he and I went hiking to a place, I probably shouldn't say the name because
Okay,
it's
that's
in
good.
central Arizona, and he doesn't like to call attention to it, but it was a day hike, and it's a canyon where you have to, hike and rappel, and we were there in the middle of summer, and you're walking through the water, so you're staying reasonably cool, and we're walking down, and we get to after the main difficulties are passed, we're sitting on a ledge there in the shade, in a contoured ledge on the granite, and he pulls out of his pack a thermos, and inside is frozen ice cream.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah, it was just incredible, And he had one for me and one for him, so
Wow.
it was like wonderful planning. But
Nice.
anyways, I just remember that lunch, and I know he listens to these summaries, so I want him to know that it really made a big impression on me. So anyways, we continued south there, and we walked up this drainage, the red wall drainage between Vishnu, I'm sorry, between Venus and Apollo.
Right.
It's very straightforward, and as you know, and we dropped our packs there, and then and then walked north up to the summit of Venus, straightforward. You know, good views and and nothing really spectacular about this summit. But we did see when we were coming up from below, as well as from the summit of Venus looking down, we could see this big pit in the red wall on the west northwest side of Apollo that had fallen out. You could see that there was a pit, and there was a huge landslide or rockfall underneath it in the red wall. And so there was all this fresh debris.
Like a sinkhole kind of thing?
Yeah, like a sinkhole that fell out, right? Yeah. So we were quite interested to see that, and it looked very, very recent, right? So when we went back down to our packs, the first thing we did after we joined our packs was to go up to the summit of Apollo, and that was a very neat place. I don't know if you must have been up there, but
yeah, it is a neat place.
Yeah, very neat place. It's just kind of, you know, almost kind of surreal landscape there. To me, it's somewhat evocative of what you see in places on the Esplanade way out west of Great Thumb.
But
where you
weird,
get hood-
but really weird erosion.
Yes, very weird erosion. Very weird. Hoodoos and caves and little valleys and very neat topography. And I suspect it's all, you know, controlled by a structural joint pattern in the rocks. But we couldn't. It wasn't obvious when, from our perspective on the ground. Anyways, a very interesting summit, and I remember we were able to get cell phone coverage up there too.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of nice to connect with our friends in Vancouver and Flagstaff. So, anyways, we went back to our packs, put the backpacks on, and then headed north around Apollo, and. Started for and we were going to pass by that that sinkhole and yeah, it was quite impressive to look down on it, and it did look pretty recent, and it's very surprising because when we got back to town, you know, a couple weeks later, I was reading Harvey's notes, and I think he went through there in 65 and he reported the same sinkhole. What we saw had been there for a while, and I'm guessing that there'd been a secondary rockfall that had fallen more recently than when Butchert was there, and that's what accounted for, you know, the recent debris that we saw. What looked to be recent anyway. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. So you know, and at this point, here's another one of this was another place where we should have read our hiking guides a little more carefully before we started the trip, because we got around to the east side of Apollo. And we the three of us start saying, well, where's the descent, you know? And, you know, Bruce and I were pretty insistent that it was down on the south side of Apollo. And so we walked over there and started poking around at the top of the red wall looking for, you know, a likely option. And Art said, no, I think it's on the north. And so, you know, we're poking around. It's starting to get late in the afternoon, too. And so we were a little nervous because we couldn't. Nothing was jumping out, right? And, you know, when you don't know where the route is, it's a little, I don't know, it puts you in a different mindset. And
yes.
So, you know, we're a little more concerned, I think, with our situation. So, but eventually, I think the three of us collectively realized that you had written it up in your hikes book and said that it was kind of more on the north side. And so we all came together and then headed to an even farther gully to the north. And there at the top, there were all these tracks, you know, from deer and sheep and heading down. And we knew, well, this must be it, right? And it still wasn't 100% certain because you go down quite a ways and, you know, you have to kind of go up over a rib of red wall and climb down the other side, right, to get to actually drop down and get below the final difficulty. And so we didn't know until we'd actually done that climb over that we'd made it all the way. But yeah, we finally got down below the red wall, and then, you know, it was a fairly straightforward walking down and to the south to get to the long rib shale that heads out to Ocoa Point. And by this time of the day, it was pretty late, so we decided we'd camp on that rib. It's a ridge, I guess, but it's just totally flat. And beautiful campsites, you know, just spectacular, because perfectly flat and a little rocky, but Therm-a-Rest mattresses deal with that.
So this is on the basalt cliffs with Ochoa Point nearby, or are you still further north of that?
No, we were about, 400 meters or half a mile northwest of Ochoa Point.
Got it.
So we were right on top of the basalt cliffs.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just a beautiful spot, yeah, you know, with tremendous views all around.
Yep.
And nice place to spend the night. And, I mean, it's, you know, when you're hiking in the canyon, sometimes you're hiking down the bottom along the river, and you have limited views of what's up above, right?
That's right.
Then when you get into a situation like this where you have these tremendously expansive views, it's a totally different experience. You know, having your evening dinner and going to bed in a setting like that, when you can see the lights of Desert View, you know, off in the distance.
Right.
So great night's sleep there, and then the next morning we put the packs on and headed out to Ochoa Point. And the other two guys weren't interested in actually doing the point itself, so they stayed behind and at a little bit of a break which dropped down the north side, and then I went down out to the end of the ridge there and worked my way down through the sandstone to get to the notch between the ridge and this blockhouse of sandstone boulders and crumbling ledges that's called Ochoa Point.
Yeah,
and it was, you know, you had to be very careful on that climb. It was a little unnerving because there's some moves that you have to make with exposure, and it's really crumbly and rotten. Mm-hmm. But you know, I felt like by being careful and level-headed, there wasn't any problem, right?
Yeah.
And so it all worked out fine, and up and down, so it was another Grand Canyon summit, fortunately for me. So, and then when I was going back to join those guys, I could see that there was an easier way to get through the Tapiz to rejoin them by going to the north around the ridge and then going up. And so that's the way I went, and then the three of us came down that way, and we started then down through the basalt cliffs. And that's a pretty difficult walk, especially with our full packs.
Right.
By this time they were like, you know, they're down four days.
You come down on the super group there, and it's kind of baked stuff. It's not... It's steep, and it doesn't let your foot kind of dig in the slope there.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And, you know, the cinders and actually not really cinders, but just the detritus from the basalt was very fine-grained and pebbly a little, like rolling, like ball bearings or something like that.
Yeah,
I remember seeing a lot of olivine in there, too. That was pretty neat. So
cool.
Sometimes, you know, you see that associated with basalt periodically. But anyways, it was, and it's in the direct open sun, too. You know, you're just facing south and east and going down these gullies, steep gullies in the basalt, and trying to dig the edges of your shoes in so you could step down. And it's just very, very tedious and demanding. And so by the time we got to the bottom, we were pretty tired, you know. It's only midday, but we were still pretty tired from it, and it was hot too. So we went down to the river and we cleaned off in the river, got some fresh water, and then we hiked up this little drainage which comes down from Ochoa Point, and you know, just hung out there in the shade for a couple of hours while we recovered and while things cooled down. And then after that, we put our packs back on and started down river, along the river. And it's pretty easy walking. There's trails here and there, places to get through a couple of small cliffs at water level. And at one point, I remember we had to walk about 10 meters and right along a cliff, right at water level. But the water was right at the perfect level that there were submerged boulders with just their tops. sticking up, and we could walk from boulder to boulder, you know, without getting wet, and then also without having to climb up above. So that was pretty cool, and we continued down and crossed Unkar Delta. I was surprised at the amount of development there, which is presumably mostly for the river runners. Yep. You know, they have the interpretive trail and complete with little booklets that you can use. And so we spent some time there, and I remember trying with a sat phone to get out because it was very wide and open and expansive. But even from that open position, my satellite phone just wouldn't raise anybody.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I mean, I think these were Iridium phones, and I think they were just at that point, the technology just wasn't advanced enough. I don't know what it was, but you know, I found that they were very fickle back then. They're better now, and so anyways, it didn't work out, but that's all right. We continued on and worked our way down river and had to climb up a couple of times, but we got to essentially the mouth of the big drainage that comes down from Rama Shrine and the Tabernacle, and it's essentially it's upstream from Escalante, about a mile.
That's right.
I think the river runners call it Upper Rattlesnake Camp.
That's right.
Okay. I may have learned that from you, but I know it's in my notes, and so we camped there a little nervously, I might add.
Especially with the name, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't see any rattlesnakes, so it was it wasn't too much of a problem. And again, you know, we were sleeping so well on this trip, so. And I remember I had Renee had given me this little tiny electronic thing where I could put on like 40 songs, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so I listened to Fleetwood Mac or something like that, you know, while I was going to sleep. And I don't normally do that kind of stuff, but it was just the perfect time to pull out the music and listen to it. So good night's sleep there, and then. So that was, you know, at that point, then we were going to be leaving the Colorado River until we got to Phantom Ranch and saying goodbye, you know, to all that ready water that we'd encountered for much of the early part of the trip. So the next morning, we got up really early and followed there's a really nice trail, as you know, that goes up to the Tabernacle.
Right, the River Runners trail.
Yeah. Okay, are you certain that the River Runners built that? Produced it?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay, because the reason I ask is because in the winter of 1880-81, Charles Walcott was doing geological work.
Maybe
in
Walcott
Eastern
did
Grand Canyon.
It. I'm not certain that Walcott didn't.
Yeah, and I remember reading one of his reports. This would have been last year or maybe 18 months ago.
Okay.
And, you know, he was in there for like 90 or 100 days, something like that.
Wow, okay.
And of course, he did the first recorded ascent of Nanquit Butte.
Right.
And then spent some time mapping out the geology of the Butte Fault. And then in his report, he talked about trail building down to the southwest limit of where he went, which was he said was around Asbestos Canyon. So
that,
you know,
very well could have been.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if, because I just remember it being a very well laid out trail, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And with switchbacks. And
yes,
and so, and now it's not to say that the deer don't build trails like that. I know they do. I've seen some beautiful,
It could be indigenous as well, because, you know, that area has been occupied for thousands of years there, so.
Oh, for sure. I guess my question is, I just was curious as to how many generations that trail has been providing access to. And as you point out, it's probably hundreds of generations, because obviously people have been using it for thousands of years. And the deer have probably upgraded it, and maybe Walcott upgraded it a bit. Who knows? And the river runners have upgraded it, too. So, and then Art and Bruce and I upgraded it very briefly on our walkthrough. In 28. So anyways, we get to the top, and I was surprised at how well this trail was, and how the trail actually goes to the top of the Tabernacle, right? So, you know, fun little summit there to pop off.
So that was easy, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, that was easy, and it's still early in the morning, right? So by the time we were up there, so we then went down and walked south to the saddle between Solomon Temple right. and the Tabernacle, and right. dropped our packs there.
Great.
And then the three of us worked our way up the east side of Solomon and to the summit there. So yep. that was another a nice little jaunt as well. And by this time, it was starting to get a little bit warmer in the mid morning, and we put our packs back on and walked down to the drainage between Sheba and Solomon.
Yes.
And had lunch there in okay. some very limited shade. And then from that point, hiked up to the notch between Sheba and Ramah Shrine. And,
yes.
and at this point, Bruce decided he'd had enough climbing for the
okay.
day.
All right.
And so we left our packs there. We left Bruce, and Art and I headed for Sheba.
Okay.
And nice little climb. You
yes.
know, the best part of it that was basically... right at the notch where we left our packs, there's some down climbs. You have to down climb a chimney
mm-hmm.
and then up climb a similar chimney on the other side of this notch just to get you on the ridge that heads south to Sheba. So we managed that and then headed to Sheba and went to the summit, found our way up to the top, and could actually look back down at Bruce. And he snapped our pictures
cool.
standing on the top, which is really cool. And he actually wrote up a review of this hike for, what was it, Outside Magazine or something like that?
Huh.
And he shows that picture, you know, the two of us on the top of Sheba
cool.
and down below. So a fun summit, right?
Yeah.
And this is the first time I ever did three summits in one day. So
oh,
that
okay.
was
cool.
that was pretty impressive, yeah. you know. And so we worked our way... The two of us worked our way back down to our packs, and we were pretty beat because of the effort. And we said, why don't we just, you know, we thought we could start up the red wall and potentially stay on top of the red wall at the base of Ramah Shrine.
Right.
And but we thought it might be pretty late by the time we got there, and we were feeling kind of tired. So we said, let's just sit here on this nice open slope, again, these open slopes, and have a relaxed evening. And so we made that commitment. You know, everybody takes their shoes off and socks, and you're all sitting there laying on your mattresses and pads and whatever, and the breeze picks up.
Oh, wow.
You know, and we thought, oh, well, this is just the typical evening breeze, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts getting a little heavier and a little heavier.
Huh.
And eventually, you know, by the time we settled in to sleep, it was gusting like 30,
wow.
I thought more than 30. Bruce, who's a pilot and knows these things better
right.
than I do,
right.
he said gusting 30, but still fast and heavy, and it blew all night long,
wow.
and just buffeting us, and we had no tent. You know, Bruce had a little solo tent that he set up, so he was protected a little bit, but Art and I were just out there on our pads with this tremendous wind blowing past us all night long. It wasn't particularly cold, but it was very noisy and buffeting.
Hmm.
And in the morning, I remember we you know had to get up, and it was one of those mornings where you don't eat. You know, you just everything you do is just to get the gear stuffed in the pack in some way you can carry it.
Hmm.
Put your shoes on and get the hell out of there.
Hmm.
You know, and I have a picture that I did manage to snap of Art, you know, Art lying in his sleeping bag with his pants horizontal in the wind
wow.
as he was trying to put his pants on, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that gives you a sense of how blustery it was. So we packed up as best we could, and then when we went up into the Redwall Ravine, the buffeting kind of ceased a little bit. It dropped down. It wasn't as bad in there. And we actually found... A little pothole of water where, with you know, using syringes, we could extract. We got about a liter out of that,
huh.
and which is free water, which
yeah.
is you know nice because we were carrying. I don't know how much we had, but it had to get us all the way to Vishnu, and we didn't know exactly how long that would take. So this was nice to get free water, and we had our breakfast in the gully there, and so I remember looking at the geology too and noticing that. The throw of the fault on the west side there is like 30 feet. You can really see dramatically
cool.
you know, the offset in the geological units mm-hmm. in the Redwall. So pretty neat place to hang out. So we get to the top of the Redwall, and it's still windy, but, you know, we're feeling better and refreshed after having breakfast. And we walked a little bit to the southwest and dropped our packs, and the three of us headed up to Rama Shrine.
Great.
So that's that was another beautiful summit. Really, you know, fun to walk up and mm-hmm. and pick out the route. Nothing complicated or difficult
easy.
Or anything
yeah.
like that.
You bet.
And we got cell phone coverage on top.
Oh wow!
So we could connect with the public once again. And
was that with your satellite phone, your Iridium phone, or
no,
your actual
no.
cell phone?
That was with the cell phone.
Wow.
So Bruce figures he was bouncing off the Echo Cliff.
Something. Wow.
For those you know, when we were on Apollo and when we were on Rama Shrine.
Huh.
So that's what he figured. I don't know because at that time I don't think there were any cell phone towers in the South Rim, right?
Okay.
I'm not sure if there are even now. So
yeah, there are. I don't know. I don't know where he was picking up, but since you know that he did.
Yeah. So he did. We were lucky to get that. And so, you know, we headed back down to the Redwall Rim, and basically it was a question of now just following the Redwall around the head of Asbestos Canyon and then over to the Krishna-Vishnu Saddle and then down into Vishnu. And I remember Art just was blistering. His pace was blistering when we were going in towards the head of Asbestos Canyon there, and basically there's the first drainage you pass or you cross that is before you get to Vishnu. There's actually a big arch in there. It's in the drainage, so it's technically a bridge, and we'd never heard about anybody describing this before. It's a big bridge. It's like it's got a 30-foot span. This is in the Redwall, at the top of the Redwall.
Oh, wow.
And you could see it. I mean, we walked right across the top, not across the top of it, but, you know, next to it.
Uh-huh.
And on the upstream side of the bridge. And it was, you know, quite impressive. I remember thinking, I'm surprised nobody's, you know, documented this before.
Yeah. Huh.
And then the hiking, you know, after you cross the head of Asbestos, it starts to ease up a little bit. I think there's a little bit more topography, more of a bench on the top of the Redwall. And so by the time we got to the Krishna Shrine Saddle, it had eased up quite a bit. But I was still feeling pretty beat because of the lack of sleep the night before.
Right.
She told Art, you know, I said, I think I'm going to sit out Krishna Shrine.
Mm.
And he said, no, you're not. He said, we're going. You know. So he and I, Bruce stayed behind. But Art and I, you know, he said, you're probably never going to come back here.
I was going to say, you worked so hard to get there.
I know. So we started off, and we actually got up it really quickly. You know, the whole round trip was like an hour. And just a fun walk up this Supai slide. And then on the top, you've probably been up there, but...
I haven't. There's a little button of Supai at the top there.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where you're going up this slide, and there's all this Supai debris, right? That's been eroded off from up on top formerly. And so when you get to the top, there is that little button of Supai, and it's like, again, it's kind of like the top of Apollo. It's not anything on the same scale, but just a little magical spot, like an oasis, right? Of
that
sandstone,
weird, eroded, yeah.
Yeah, with pinions in there, you know, and.
Yeah.
And just a very neat summit. Again, a very rewarding summit, and you know, not the least because I had almost passed on it, right?
Right.
So I was very thankful that he had.
Oh, good for Art.
Yeah, that he had pushed us to do that. So,
so
at that point we headed north, and there's a big drop a big Redwall break that goes down into Vishnu.
Right.
And you know we kind of both or all three of us knew that this went, but we didn't know the details.
And you guys also have your Clear Creek flyway, you know, the Clear Creek, what do you call it, highway or something, whatever.
Yeah, the freeway.
The freeway, yeah, yeah. So,
yeah.
So you must be thinking, gee, we just need to connect up with that.
That's right. We knew once we got there, we'd be fine, right?
Right.
And so so basically, we had to find a way down into Vishnu. And so we knew that this break existed, and we just didn't know the details. And mm-hmm. it was one of those things where it keeps you guessing. You know, it goes, it's very steep, but it goes, and it goes, and it goes. And then you get to a big drop at the bottom, and you're thinking, oh, boy, you know, hope something works out here. And then you follow ledges along horizontally, and you get to another break, and then you're through, right? And it just... you know, you just got to keep working at it, and eventually you're down. And so we were into the drainage of Vishnu, and very shortly, you know, we joined the area, we rejoined the area that I'd hiked around in with Art a few years previously. And so we camped there just below the Krishna drainage that we'd come down, maybe a half mile downstream at the first water. And then the next morning... At that point, it's like you said, we knew we had to hike the Clear Creek Freeway, and for us, for Art and I, the trip was kind of over. You know, even though we're in Vishnu Creek, everything we knew we'd be walking was previously trod ground for us. So it was kind of like the end of the trip. But for Bruce, he hadn't been along the freeway, so that was new for him. But we essentially followed Vishnu down to, you remember the drainage I called the Frog Island drainage?
Yes.
Where the little frog was, so we went up that, and this is such a beautiful little spot, this little oasis, because there's always been water in that drainage when I've gone through there. And just a small flow, but very persistent. And, you know, at this time there was a big plunge pool at the bottom where it joined Vishnu, and maybe, you know, the pool was maybe 2 feet deep, with a bunch of frogs in there singing and everything, with a long waterfall coming down the sandstone above it. Really just idyllic spot. So we followed the flow up into the spring, which is actually up in the shale just below the red wall, and we filled up our water bottles there, and then followed the drainage up to the top of the red wall. And from there, again, it was just a straightforward romp, as you know, over to the Angel's Gate Saddle, and then down there and into Clear Creek. And basically, the rest of the hike, you know, we walked down Clear Creek. There were plenty of people camping there, but we hiked up the trail, the Clear Creek Trail, anticipating that we would stop somewhere on the Tonto. And you know, we'd had so many fabulous campsites that our standards were pretty high at this point. And so we're blasting along on the Tonto, the Clear Creek trail on the Tonto platform,
right,
looking for campsites. And we didn't actually find something nice until we got over to where the trail basically is going below Bradley and Demaray points, and which was a lot farther than we expected. You know, we thought we would find something somewhere in the Zoroaster Canyon area. But again, it's all just quaternary boulders and alluvium, and so nothing really, no place nice to put your sleeping bag down. So eventually we found a nice spot in the dark and crashed there. And then, what can I say? The rest of the trip was pretty uneventful. The next morning we got up and hiked the rest of the Clear Creek Trail, dropped down to Phantom Ranch, and then came up the Bright Angel. And again, you know, I came up in about 3 hours and 20 minutes, which isn't too bad for me. And
good.
I remember
really
coming...
Good.
What's that?
That's really good.
Yeah. But, you know, look, this is 10 days of hiking, right? Under your belt. So, anybody should be really good by that point. So, but Art was... He did 302.
Wow.
So, it was, you know... The glory days, I guess, being young and fit.
Yeah.
So a really fabulous hike, you know, and we got to the top, and the car was right where it was expected. There were no tickets, and everything worked out. Everything worked out fine. So a really, really memorable trip. I'm so glad I got to do it with those two fellows. So
really nice.
Great experience.
Where are we going to talk about next time?
Well, the next trip, if you want to hear about it, was in the fall of 2008.
Okay.
And again with Art and Bruce, and this time we went from Crystal to Shinimo.
Huh.
did a big loop that way. And so if you want to hear about that, we can chat next week or whenever.
Let's do it. All right. Well, that was a wonderful recounting of a wonderful hike from Nankoweap to Bright Angel. And so let's conclude this Part 23 Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is November 21st, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Tom. Great talking with you.
You too. Hang on.